Hello.
How are you? My voice is slightly croaky today. That's because it's the day after the BAFTA Awards as I'm recording this. And I'm not going to lie, I had a brilliant night, not just at the awards, but a few of the parties afterwards. So it was an early morning finish this morning, hence why I'm a little bit croaky and maybe a little bit deeper than expected. Congratulations to everybody, both, you know, all the nominees, but everybody who won as well. All Quiet on the Western Front, I mean, winning an outstanding number of awards. And yeah, the speeches I thought were absolutely fantastic. And if you haven't already, you can listen to Edward, the director and writer, and Volker Bertmann, the composer, who picked up the BAFTA for Best Score last night on a previous episode. There's a couple actually as well, Banshees of Inisherin. Massive congratulations to Kerry and Barry and Martin and all his team. You can listen back to Martin on a previous episode, also his composer, Carter Borwell. Charlotte Wells, yay! She got a BAFTA for After Sun. And you can hear Charlotte on a previous episode as well. Cate Blanchett talking about Tar. Yeah, feel very lucky that we've been able to feature so many of the nominees and winners on the podcast. I'll stick up loads of links up on social to guide you through to some of them if you haven't checked them out already. But our latest guest on soundtracking is Ben Caron, a director who cut his teeth on numerous TV shows like The Crown and Andor, and has now directed his very first feature film for Apple TV. It's also shown in cinemas as we speak. It's called Sharper, and it's a twisty, turny tale, I'd say, where nothing is really quite as it seems. It stars Julianne Moore, Sebastian Stan, John Lithgow, and is scored by our wonderful friend Clint Manso. I can't and I won't tell you too much about this film, but what I will say is that it kind of lulls you into a false sense of what you think the film is about very cleverly, and then kind of takes you off on a bit of a journey. Brilliant performances, not least from Julianne Moore. She's just brilliant in this film, and her and John Lithgow together, really, really interesting. So yeah, either go and see it at the cinema or go and check it out on Apple TV. But first, before we get to Ben, a word from our friends at Gusto. Now, I might have mentioned on some previous episodes of the podcast that I really like cooking. However, I'm going to be honest with you right now. I've got to the point where I've fallen into a bit of complacency with what I cook. It's basically the same things every week. I've bored myself and God knows how my family feel about it. Well, thank goodness for Gusto and its menu of over 250 recipes to spice things up. What's not to love about a box arriving with pre-portioned fresh ingredients and easy to follow recipe cards? This week we had a delicious chicken korma and then a spiced shakshuka with feta. Very yummy. Now, even if you are in any way intimidated by the idea of cooking, believe me, Gusto makes it so easy and totally achievable. Gives you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals every week. And as I said, there are over 250 recipes to choose from, and you can have them delivered to your door any day of the week. So, how would you like 60% off your first box, followed by 25% off all boxes for 2 months? Well, if you do, then head to cook.gusto.co.uk/claim. That's cook.gusto, that's GUSTO.co.uk/claim. I'll also stick a link up on our socials so you can click through. So why not start enjoying quality dishes today? That's 60% off your first box plus 25% off all boxes for 2 months by heading to cook.gusto.co.uk/claim. Now I'm hungry. And so to Ben and his debut feature Sharper, and we'll begin with one of Clint's cues from the movie. Do you like martinis?
Thank you.
This is so exciting, Benjamin Caron, because we're talking about your first feature film. How does it feel?
I don't know. It's terrifying because in the past, I guess, there's always someone you could kind of hide behind. If The Crown wasn't very good, oh, well, that's Peter Morgan's fault. If Andor wasn't very good, oh, well, that's Tony Gilroy's fault. Whereas now, they're like, there's no one else you can really hide from. So, you know, my head's firmly on the block.
Well, I tell you what was really lovely from, you know, not just watching the film, but reading the production notes as well, is hearing your team, you know, those people that you brought, producers and whatnot and stuff, that and writers, that the connection that you had with the story and what how impressed they were with your, because I think that's a really interesting thing as well, that people maybe don't kind of realise is sometimes the journeys to get into direct films. You know, in terms of you connected with the story and you pitched for it, you had clear ideas of what you saw, and that those clear ideas really impressed people like Julianne Moore, who, I mean, she gushes about you in these production notes. It's beautiful. You know, you were on the same page, basically. What was it about the story, the characters, the, you know, the script that you were like, yes?
That they're all incredibly kind. I had to pay them a lot of money to say all of these things. But yeah, no, they did. I mean, Julianne Moore essentially was the reason, you know, I came onto this movie. That she was the one who pretty much got this film going. You know, it was Brian and Alex had written a brilliant script. It wasn't produced. It hadn't been picked up. It was sort of sitting on this thing called The Blacklist. And, you know, it was brought to her by her management team. And she was looking for great parts. And there was a great part in there for Madeline. And as soon as she said yes, then, you know, Apple and A24 are like, oh, okay, Julianne Moore wants to make a movie. We'll make that with you. And then it became the sort of the search for a director. But when I first read the script, you know, Alex and Brian had just written this really smart, funny, character-driven, original movie, which there weren't that many out there. And I just liked how it was devious. It was a thriller. I loved how it sort of played around with sort of sexual politics, with trust and betrayal, and I loved all the twists and turns. It was like a sort of a poker game. And for my taste, I like the looks and the feels of those character-driven thrillers, which I love from the 70s, like Clute or Thomas Crown Affair. And also, I guess, one of the things I sort of pitched to them was like, look, I'm English, and I think I can bring a outsider's sensibility to this story about people trying to sort of enter and pass through different worlds. And maybe that's hopefully advantageous to me telling this story.
Did you have any music references at all in that pitch?
Oh, I wasn't expecting that question. No music in my pitch. And to the point where actually one of the execs from A24, Noah, said, what kind of music are you hoping to use in this film? And I sort of said, oh, I don't know. I genuinely don't know, because I don't think I'm ready to declare that yet.
Yeah.
And it was way too early. And everything I'd sort of listened to, I just didn't feel like it. And I was like, that's just not how I work. I'm really sorry. I'm going to be really honest. It's not how I work. It's a long process. And I'm not sure, you know, we sort of make up the reasons afterwards why and hope they make sense. But I just didn't know at that time what it was going to be. I do know that kind of as an idea, the score and the sort of source tracks have to kind of work together to take us somewhere, someplace kind of unexpected.
Yeah.
And the idea that they're going to add to the story through music is integral, but I just wasn't ready to declare what that was in terms of either kind of composer or ideas about sort of needle drops.
It's quite a tricky project to talk about in any great detail in terms of content, because you don't want to spoil it for anyone, because it is an amazing kind of journey watching it, you know, in terms of, like you say, the twists and turns and everything that kind of unveils itself and doesn't unveil itself and all that kind of thing. So what I can see, because there was a few, I checked in the production notes just because it does mention it, is the idea that, and it's such a brilliant way of storytelling, actually, is that each act is a different character's perspective.
Yeah.
And with that, there's a through line musically, but there's also its own sound in a way, which is really clever. And it works so brilliantly because you start the film thinking you're watching a certain type of film, and then you go, no, I'm not. It's so great. It's so, so good. And the
Oh.
music really contributes, I think, to that as well. So talk to me a little bit about the choices as well, in terms of, because there's some fantastic needle drops in there. I said to you, because you asked me about this, and I was like, I don't want to mention too many of them because I'd love to just to hear your natural kind of storytelling through them. But there are a couple, like the Talking Heads track is brilliant.
Yeah.
But then Clint Mansell doing the score,
Yeah.
inspired. So what kind of came first? Were the cues written, or with the needle, what was the kind of, what was the journey of that music, I
Okay.
guess?
Okay, good question. So I guess the hiring the composer and the music supervisor was sort of happened at kind of around about the same time, but Clint was almost, was high up on my list, almost probably at the top of someone that I really, really wanted to work with. Coincidentally, we're from the same very small town in the West Midlands, Stourbridge. His parents still go and have Sunday lunch in my dad's pub. So that's not a reason to hire him, by the way. But I was like, there aren't that
It's a good
many people
start.
that there aren't there aren't that many people that come out of Stourbridge and go and work in Hollywood. So I was like, that is pretty bonkers. And he used to be in a band called Pot Will Eat Itself, which I kind of knew of, but I remember some of those members left and came went on and were in the Wonder Stuff, and I had those posters on my wall when I was at school. So I knew of him and I knew his background, and then I probably I definitely knew about his music from his work with Darren Aronofsky from Pi, and then later on Requiem for a Dream. So, which was, I remember listening to that score. It was a game changer. I'd never heard anyone do anything like that with a score before. It was just knockout. So I was like, oh, the producer, do you think we could, see if Clint's available? And he was, and we met, and we just, I don't know, we just connected again, just talking about home, and again, a bit about he loved Sharper for all the same reasons that I loved it. And we talked about how, in some way, all our characters are lost or broken, and how the sort of story provides a lot of room to bring some of the kind of unspoken subtext to the film. And one of the kind of challenges we had was how do we reflect the different narrative perspectives of each chapter? With the score, if we kept changing the music, it would our kind of feeling was that it would become chaotic. So actually the score needed to be a cohesive thread throughout. And it naturally felt that that was Sandra, and because her story is so central to Sharper. And we feel and see so many kind of things from her point of view that, so her stories have inspired the spine of the score. And so he set off and started to kind of put together ideas during the shoot. And then really early on during a rough assembly, he started handing over demos, and he instantly had a really good instinct. And he's a very smart composer because he knows he wants to get his music in that film as soon as possible, because directors can get really attached to temp music. And so it's really important that they get, you get your composer's music in there from the beginning. And I remember him sending that first batch of demos, and me just sort of jumping up and down with joy, just getting really excited about where this soundscape was going. So that was the beginning of the journey with the score. And then in terms of the source tracks, my editor Jan Mars, and we worked together for the last 10 years, who, by the way, is a kind of the sort of fourth person in this quadrangle of soundscape, because he's just brilliant with music. And he had worked with someone called Simon Astle, who had just come off the back of Big Little Lies, and he'd worked on Come On, Come On, another A24 film, and American Honey. And he just felt like a perfect fit. And we talked about how we wanted tracks that were timeless and could have a kind of feeling and an undertone of a sort of New York jazz and soul. But I just didn't want that. I didn't want that music to date easily. And so it had to sort of, and that's a, you know, it's a really hard thing to find. So we had to kind of get that balance right, but that the music could reflect the character, but also the location. So those two things were really important. And to stay away from anything way too modern or kind of on the nose, but that the sounds that could be playing around them, maybe at home or in their car or restaurants or at parties. So, and finding that source music that could sort of feel real and then bleed out into the film and could work over like a montage. So I guess to start, maybe we start at the beginning. So we have our title sequence, which actually is constructed with sounds taken from Clint's score, what you call them, the little stems, and my editor put that together. And that title sequence was actually the hardest thing we had to make. It's been so many different things. It was harder to make that title sequence than it was the film. I mean, that's another story. It was incredibly complicated. It was just an idea I had when I was filming about the idea of making a fake Rolex watch. That was always the idea. But the sort of sound to it has changed so many times. But eventually we just sort of, you know, the motto of this film was always simplify, and eventually we sort of went back to some of the stems from Clint's score, and Jan, my amazing, you know, the amazing editor, sort of put that together, and it's brilliant. So he starts off the film in many ways, and then we come into Tom, who is played by Justice Smith, and we meet him working in a bookshop, and in the background on the radio we hear Irma Thomas, Ruler of My Heart, and he's alone in that bookshop, he's lost in this world of fiction, hiding from the sort of outside world, and then in steps Sandra. And it's funny because he's sort of annoyed that someone has come in and dare
disrupted
ask
him
for a book. He's like sort of, he's kind of reluctantly taken out of this literary bubble, and, or, you know, from the not real to the real. And I love that track by Emma. I think it's so soulful. It's just a lovely way to bring you in to Tom's chapter.
Ruler of my heart, robber of my soul, where can you be? I wait patiently. My heart cries out. When you're alone, the going gets rough. Come back.
Is it hard to almost remove your own emotional connection to music when you are kind of working out what works? You've got to facilitate the character, the relationship, the emotion, the moment in the film sort of thing. And sometimes it's so hard to disassociate yourself and your personal connections with pieces of music.
I'm going to be really honest, and I'll probably regret saying this, but I didn't have a childhood when I have a great relationship with music. Maybe that's helped me now, because when I was at school, when I was like 11 years old, I went to school, we had our first music lesson. I was told by the teacher that you're tone deaf. And so I kind of got put off music and a love of music when I was sort of younger. And so you had to, because to be part of the kind of group of friends you were with, you felt like you had to know about bands. But I never really had a strong connection to music in a way that you know, like you do, or friends of mine do. So
Yeah.
I respond. Maybe this is helpful. So I don't have a real affinity to one particular thing. So I
Yeah.
respond generally in a kind of feel of something, and through that, you know, through the scene or through the character.
That's
So it's
great.
quite good in a way. You know, my suggestions I always put forward are always, you know, terrible. But that's why I love having a, you know, music supervisor who comes on board and surprises you with so much. You know, I think at the end of that scene when Tom, well, what can happen is you can really get bedded into a track, like something. So there was a track actually where when Tom and Sandra head off on their first date, we had this great track by Santa and Johnny, and it has this really great opening, and it was in for a long, long, long time. And then, as you get towards the end of the film, you start to find out which of the tracks you can use. I mean, there's a good music supervisor will be doing that as you're going along, and will sort of know, you know, should know whether you can use them or not. And this track had been used before, so there shouldn't have been a problem. But Santa and Johnny had gone missing, and we couldn't find him, or Simon couldn't find him, and he apparently gone missing in Italy. And after a few months, I think we almost sent someone out there to try and track him down. We had like a PO box number. You get to a point where you have to find an alternative track, and that's really painful because it had there was the, there
Yeah.
were just specifics about that track which felt right. It sort of kicks off the beginning part of the two of them on their first date, but. What ended up happening, we found this artist called Masatoshi Nakamura, and it was a kind of piece of music that it was a Japanese restaurant. It might have been played on
Yeah.
vinyl there, and it was a kind of perfect fit. And it had the same opening, those same opening bars that the Santa and Johnny did. So it was actually ended up probably being more appropriate, and it also felt like it was something that could be played in that restaurant.
の坂道はこの葉模様の石畳まばゆく白い長い壁足跡も影も残さないでたどり着けない山の中へ続いて
A great story. If you ever need anyone to travel the world to find missing musicians in the future, I'm just putting myself forward for that role.
Okay. Edith, go and find Santo. Track him down and just tell him he's lost a load of money.
That sounds like the best job in the world, like part detective, part kind of music historian. That's brilliant. I love it. Oh my God, that's so good. It's almost like there's a lot of the time that, you know, that's a great example of there's a great story attached to how and why a piece of music ends up in a film. It's not sometimes as easy as going, I want that one, you know, and it can be all for all manner of reasons, really. But that's I like the extremities of that. That's great.
Yeah, there's a beautiful track that sort of happens, which takes it's like that first act, the first Tom's chapter is, if you know nothing about this film, you're gonna start this movie thinking you're watching something else,
Yeah.
and I certainly lean into that, and you know, we have this great track by Curtis Harding, I Won't Let You Down, and it sort of plays over this couple falling in love montage, which is such a kind of classic of a rom-com in many ways, but maybe a kind of our or my version of it. You know, it sort of has soul, and it's sort of sexy, it's kind of dangerous, they're kind of getting to know each other. That worked brilliantly for that moment of seeing these two people fall in love.
Take your time. Don't worry, baby. Everything is fine.
actually, that whole first act with Tom, we only used source music, you know, all the way through. And so that whole first chapter, it was really important that we were off on this love journey, and I wanted it to feel electric and focus on the romance and being the kind of emotional heart of the film, because actually you need that for the end of the film to pay off. And
yeah,
once their romance feels authentic, you know, what happens will feel even more surprising. So we use source music until about 18 minutes in the film, and then we sort of bring Clint in. And it was about, I guess for us, it was about sort of not tipping our hat too much to the audience or letting the sort of music get ahead of the story. So it sort of responds to what we're seeing and feeling. And this piece of music, which I think is called 350 grand, you know, I remember hearing it the first time and I cried. It was, and you can never forget, you know, you always try and have that same feeling again, but you never do. But I just felt the desperation and the kind of emotional heart of that piece of music. It's absolutely heartbreaking, and it's all Clint.
But it's really clever though, because like you say, that kind of opening sequence has got kind of sort of sounds of that score. So it's kind of wormed its way into your kind of psyche in a way, sort of thing.
Totally. So
it's really clever, really, really clever. And it's that idea as well. And I think the music does a great job because, you know, these not given too much away by saying for some of these actors, they're almost playing two characters in a way as well. And the music, I think, does a great job of telling us things, I think, like that, the Dirty Laundry track, John Henley's track as well. You know, that's that scene, you know, that piece of music sort of tells us, is like almost unveiling some kind of narrative to us, I think, in a way as well. It's really clever.
Do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, why not? Would you mind?
Yeah. Okay. I didn't know whether you wanted to go in order, because I was going to just quickly whiz through the film, like do Sandra, but do you want me to just jump to that?
I don't mind. It's up to you. I mean, I'm not sure we'll have. Well, to go through everything. So maybe if there's specifics you want to talk about.
Yeah. Okay. I've got another. I've got basically three or four that I want to mention.
Perfect.
That's definitely one of them. So let me get to that. Otherwise, I have to go kind of weirdly
chronologically.
My brain may not. It will just sort of collapse in on itself slightly. But but we have Sandra and her kind of chapter, and we had for ages we had this track by Roy Orbison called It Wasn't Very Long Ago, and I again, it was one of those tracks I loved, and it just worked, and it was in there until I think the day before we locked the picture. And I remember I had a conversation with one of the brilliant execs at A24, Zach, and he said to me, you know, look, all the music you've used so far in the whole film is just brilliant, but does this one feel Sandra? And it was like a sort of bubble just burst in my head. I was like, oh, I don't know. And then it was like, okay, Simon, you know, what have you got? Let's go back to the soundtracks. And we went back to the Supremes track, Just a Lonely Christmas. And it was perfect. And it just helped with the feeling of Christmas, the sense of sort of Sandra's isolation. And it was something that I could definitely believe her grandmother could have played when she was growing up. Although actually we didn't lose Roy completely. We ended up sort of putting him into the bar and sort of playing from the jukebox. But it was one of those last minute things that actually was, I'm really happy that we changed.
Just a lonely, lonely Christmas. What a glad one it would be.
so then we kind of get more into the score from Clint, and he gets to play with all these brilliant synth sounds that, you know, that I sort of pushed him to kind of this sort of strange alternative kind of underground New York City and not kind of traditional drama in New York. And, you know, he has this amazing track that we sort of use for the drive and for kind of the building Sandy, which I kind of pitched him as a kind of educating Rita meets Rocky. and you know, and it's like this sort of this warmth and this how it kind of builds this sort of star pupil. And then there's this moment where sort of our two characters are going on to this journey into, you know, into New York. And I always thought that it was going to be score or certainly an instrumental piece. And, you know, you didn't want to be distracted by any lyrics and you wanted just to indulge in those visuals, possibly, you know, electronic. It for me, it was about the kind of, you know, New York and what was New York and this sort of city that kind of operated at the sharp end of the American dream and this sort of transactional city. And so Simon was like, okay, I've got this piece of music that you should just have there for as a temp while Clint's still working on that. And it was one of those tracks that I just couldn't let go. And it stayed there. And Clint, he gave us a couple of really good alternatives, but it never quite, it's the only one that I ashamedly hung on to. And I said, Clint, I asked his permission. I said, look, I'm really sorry. Do you mind? I can't. And he's such a lovely man and so gracious. He was like, not at all. You should hang on to it. And it's Detroit by Disaster Piece. Yeah. And the atmosphere, the way, you know, when we put it to pictures, it just connected. It was like a sort of urban Blade Runner.
It's amazing that, isn't it, where kind of you've kind of put so much work into to shooting and to directing, you know, and the colours in the film as well, I absolutely love. And sometimes just the right piece of music can do something that you kind of can't really quite describe, but it's a feeling. It feels right. There's nothing else that tells you that it's right apart from the feeling.
Yeah, and then Clint comes, you know, he comes racing back in at the end of that chapter and he's like, we've got Sandra, we've got Max. They are, you know, she is sort of at the end of her training. She's complete. And he drops this track and it is so sexy and so like, just like vibrates on screen. And then, and like, just as you're like, sort of, you know, vibrating in your chair, we sort of drop into Max and we have this brilliant track by Talking Heads, Slippery People.
So good.
Which I love, and I can imagine, you know, it's just the perfect introduction to Max, and I can imagine, you know, I can imagine David Byrne, you know, turning up at this uptown Manhattan penthouse and going like, "What the fuck is this?" You know, and it's like, and that clash between that music and suddenly we come into this wealthy billionaire's penthouse, and it's when we've got this jazz, And that's Samara Joy. She was there singing that live, and that those two kind of sounds pushing up against was something right from day one. Was like, this is what I want. I want Max, and he's going to come in and you know, be like a sort of whirlwind, a bomb that's about to explode in sort of Richard's Rich's apartment. And we again that track was on right from very early on. We tried so many other tracks because even though you sometimes go, this is it, because we're listening to it so many times,
Yeah.
you do start to get a little bit jaded and
Yeah.
you kind of lose a bit of your confidence. So we had Rolling Stones in there, we had David Bowie. We were trying, classics, non-classics, and we keep, but the actually the our like my sister Jodie, who's a co-producer on the movie, and even sort of the producer in America were like, no, please go back to Talking Heads, please go back to Talking Heads. And we kept going, yeah, and we kept sort of playing with them. And then it comes to the moment where you have to declare it and go, and Jan and I would look at each other and go, no, nothing has beaten this track. So it was there from the beginning and it was there at the end, and I'm really, really happy.
And it's really interesting because those two pieces of music you talk about, the Samara Joy and the Talking Heads thing, they're basically the kind of two lives that he's leading almost in a way.
Yes, exactly.
It's so great.
Exactly.
I've not given anything away there, have I? No.
No, you're not. No,
No.
no, I think, no,
I'm
not
so
at all.
cautious of kind of like,
Yeah. Well, I don't know when people are going to listen to this. I don't know. I mean, I think for me, audiences love stories about people who come from nowhere and reinvent themselves and, in unexpected and kind of sort of deceptive ways. And I think transformation is hugely seductive. And I, you know, we the idea of entering one world and moving into another is the sort of realm of fairy tales. It's Cinderella going to the ball. It's it's Eliza in Pygmalion, and it's Vivian in Pretty Woman. So I think we or I respond positively to stories of sort of reinvention or transformation. And I think we love them. We love to sort of see. I mean, it's like sort of wish fulfillment.
From what you've done prior to this film, like The Crown and Andor as two examples, you've worked with like pretty big names, in terms of you've directed some pretty big names, and it's lovely to get the chance, I guess, to work with John Lithgow again,
Yeah.
from directing him as Winston
Love that
Churchill to
man.
Richard in this film. Seeing him and Julianne Moore together as well, I was like, why have they never done like tons of films together before? Because it's a really interesting and brilliant on-screen partnership. But what is she? I mean, in my eyes, she's just a kind of this kind of maiden. She's normal, but she's cool, and she's just, oh, anyway, what's she like to direct? And that, and talking about directing her, there is that scene that features the Don Henley track as well, which is just watching her dance is like, oh,
It's difficult to talk about any of these characters without giving away, but I
yeah.
love Julianne Moore is exceptional. She is one of those actors who loves to act and is brilliant at acting, and she's about as good as it gets. And more importantly, she is a really nice human being, generally. And
Good.
I'm not, I really mean that. And I think, she was on this project right from the beginning, and is a producer on the movie, and I loved working with her. And and one of the great moments was when we see her and Sebastian arrive in this sort of dive bar in Queens, and we have this really great track by Don Henley called Dirty Laundry. And it was just so fitting for at this moment in the film, these two lead characters who are kind of celebrating a win, and where nothing is really what it seems. They lose themselves in dance, in movement, in music, and this sort of incredible melody, and there's this, I don't know, there's a kind of power dynamic to the moment, to which the, for me, the lyrics just really connected. It's raw, it's intense, and it comes at a really key point in the film.
With
And
something
there
like
was,
that, was it choreographed or was it a case of?
so it was, so I remember saying to Julie, like, we've got this, it wasn't actually written in the film. And I was like, look, I think there's a moment here where we can have a bit of light relief and celebrate these guys and have a dancing. You know, and I look, you know me, I love a dance. I love a dance moment. You know, we did in Fairy Tale with Emma Corrin, we had that moment with the Elton John track, and even going way back to Vanessa Kirby all the way
In
back
the
in
car.
62. Exactly. Or in her apartment where she's sort of smashing up the room, and then later on when she's in love, she sort of, you know, we play these two tracks. So I love that moment as a filmmaker, was expressing something different. So yes, we found the track really early on, and I always sort of, again, Jan sent it to me and was like, what about this? And I was like, oh man, I like it. It's like, it's really dirty and it sounds great. But, you know, do you think we can get away with it? And he was like, yeah, we can definitely get away with it. I was like, he's like, this movie's amazing. Any music I put on it just sticks. It's like, I don't understand. Like, normally you try music and it sort of takes a while. It's like, this film takes any music. But I was like, okay, fine. Let me. I need to get. You know, I need to check to see how the actors feel about it, because you can't. You know, well, maybe it's just my approach, but you want to make sure that they're on board with that. So I sent it to Sebastian Stan, who plays Max, and Julianne Moore. And Sebastian came back and was like, "Man, this is my favorite track of all time. Are you fucking?"
No.
He's like, "You fucking serious? I love this track. I love Don Henley." He's like, "Have you got permission?" And I was like, "No, but as you sort of, you go, yeah, that wouldn't be a problem." And then I sort of, you know, and then Julie came back. It's like, yeah, it's great. So then I was like, okay, well, look, we're gonna film this live with this music, and we're gonna get a choreographer. And Amy Herman, who was the line producer, was like, well, you've got to go and get Susan Stroman. And Susan Stroman is like this sort of very famous choreographer, director in her own right, from Broadway. And I was like, do you think she'll do it? And she was like, yeah, of course she'll do it. It's Julianne Moore, Sebastian Stan. So I got in touch with her, and I sort of said the track I was thinking about. And she was like, yeah, I will definitely come and play for a day. So yes, we had, she said to me, as long as you can give me the title, sort of, what did she say? Something like sort of strip bar choreographer or something like that, which I don't think we'll get to change the mind. But anyway, she was really game. And so we choreographed for that track, and then on the day we had that blasting into the bar. But sort of in tandem to that, we are now have to get permission from Don Henley. And Simon, the music supervisor, like, by the way, this has never been used in a film before. I'm like, and that's
Really?
never, yeah, I know. That's what I said. It's sad. I know. I've heard it maybe, but I don't. Anyway, you go online. I hope that someone will probably come up and go, oh yeah, it was using this. But no, it's never been used in a movie before, which is naturally is brilliant, because you go, oh wow, we can own this. But it's also terrifying, because you're like, well, why hasn't been used in the movie before? So I was like, well, maybe you should write a letter to Don. So write a letter to Don Henley, and you know, I'd had a track record with this, because I had to write to Elton John before to get for the Crown, and we had to send that episode to him to see. And so I was like, okay,
I
you
know how
know,
this
I've had,
works.
yeah, I know how this works. Exactly. Mr. You know, dear Don, no, Mr. Henley. Okay, yeah, right. And then you send this letter, and it goes out, and then it's like waiting, and we're waiting, and we've shot it. All the actors think we get to use this track, because I've sort of, you know, I've obviously want to keep their confidence up, and you're saying, oh yeah, we're going to use the track, we're going to use the track. And the good news is, as he is, that he came back and eventually said, yes, I'm happy for you to use the track. I didn't get any personal note from Don, but I just kind of heard
Thumbs up.
from yeah, that it's fine for us to use. So yeah, thank fuck we got to use
Wow.
Don, and it's in, and
It's so good.
it's not going anywhere. Yeah, I love it.
One more,
yeah. Do you want to do a needle drop or a bit of score? What do you think?
Be nice to do a bit of score if that's okay. Yeah. Just to kind of, we've talked a little bit, yeah, about Clint and that kind of journey, but there are a lot of brilliant needle drops in the film, but the score has got such an important job within and around that, because not only has it got to work being on either side of these needle drops, it's got to run through these different acts of character perspective. It's got to do a lot, and it's got to work, and it absolutely does. Is there a piece of Clint's score that you're particularly proud of, or you're just kind of so, that just works so brilliantly, is a great example for you?
I mean, I do. I love all of the music that Clint has created for Sharper, but I'll give you two tracks that really stand out for me. And they both have a very different journey, actually. So there's a moment in the film where we're in Madeline's chapter, and suddenly everything has changed. We've just come off the back of relishing her success, and the pressure is back on her. And we start to really double down on the thriller element in the film, and we start to push the internal sort of psychology, so to speak. Mm. And there's a moment where she has to find Max. It's really important that she finds Max. And Jan and I were quite cheeky, because we had, when we were sort of temping some of the film that Clinton not got to yet, because, you know, he's an artist and it sort of takes a while to get there, we had gone back into his back catalogue and used pieces of music from other films that he had worked on. And for that moment, we used his famous Requiem, which in hindsight now is probably the worst thing you can do to a composer, is then, you know, say, oh, look, we put this on here, which, can you beat it? And then, we sent him that reel, and then we didn't hear from him for 3 weeks. Quiet, nothing at all. He just disappeared, and we thought maybe we'd finished him off. But he was like, that was it. He wasn't coming back. He was like, you can't do that to me. But he did. He came back, and he not only did he give us something that was so brilliantly unique to our film, I think he did reach those levels again, and not only that, he got his guitar out, which was so exciting, and right. It was just a great piece of music, which we just follow Madeline's descent, and it just gets twisty and twirly, and I just love it. And then the other piece, which is probably Just because I'm going to say this, it's not, it's surprising in a way, because I'm choosing a piece of music that plays over the credits at the very end of the film. This is me encouraging people to watch right to the very end of the film, of course. But it was a piece of music that Clint wrote really early on that was actually going to play in the Tom and Sandra falling in love montage. And yeah. I remember when he wrote that and we put that to picture, it was just heart-achingly beautiful. And it was so perfect, but also it wasn't right because it sort of was melancholic, and it gave away something too that much, we didn't want to give away in that moment of the movie, and it broke my heart to sort of take it out of there. And you know, and Curtis Harding found his way in instead, and you know, became part of that conversation about, you know, holding back the score to the end of the chapter. But I love that piece of music so much, and I was so happy that we could use that in the film, although, you know, right at the very end. And in a way, it sort of is fitting there, because at the end of the film, we're left with the same two characters that we started the film with Tom and Sandra. And they've been through so much to get to this point. It's a profound moment, and we don't know what's going to happen to them after that moment, you know, when they leave that bookshop, but they have changed.
This has been such a nice chat, because no one kind of goes into so much detail about the specific, and it's been so brilliant. And just and I think also because of that kind of the different perspectives that each act has, it's really lovely to hear, you know, you talk about some of them and the specifics about the relevance to character and the relevance to narrative as well. It's lovely. It's so great. And your enthusiasm for it's just absolutely infectious.
Oh, thanks again.
I could talk to you for a good amount more time than this, but we've run out of time. But thank you so much, Ben. And it's such an exciting time as well for, you know, what's next for you. And you know, we didn't even get to talk about Andor or The Crown, really. We got a little bit of Crown there as well. So I hope we can have another sitting and we can talk about.
I would like that very much.
Stuff as well. Yeah, in person next time too.
For sure. Thank you.
Bye.
From the score to Sharper, that's You Can't Cheat an Honest Man by Clint Mansell, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtrackin' with the wonderful Ben Caron. My huge thanks to Ben for taking the time to talk to us. You can watch Sharper on Apple TV right now and in selected cinemas, and it really is a hugely entertaining slice of neo-noir. Spoken to Clint on the podcast several times and very much look forward to having him on in the future. If you'd like to listen to any of those previous conversations, head to edithbowman.com to find them and every other episode. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK. And please do subscribe to our YouTube channel for loads of bonus content. Next up, we have a bonus episode with the boys from Son Lux, who scored Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, which we'll be dropping very, very soon. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.